This brings me back to my youth, CCI. Never mind.
Any, who's doing this, Aga? Are you, or Evan?
I'll handle this.
Okay, Evan?
Would you like a summary, or
is there anything specific you'd like to, anything here, commissioners, that we have concerns about, or? Okay, I don't know, Evan.
Just, I know that I...
I waited too long.
Yeah, you should have gaveled it down. What are the CCRs attached to? Are they attached to deeds to lots?
These will be, this will be a document that will be attached to subdivision approvals and will be the document that one of the governing documents as to how homeowners will work with each other, the rules that they have to live by within that subdivision. So what we have is a sample, and the applicant will be submitting a set of covenants, conditions, and restrictions with each subdivision application for the commission's approval. But we can expect that this template will be essentially what you will see.
But how would somebody researching the county registry find that this set of rules is
These would actually be recorded with the subdivision plat.
Okay.
And so anybody going in could see what the declaration is by which all lot owners would have to live.
And so there's no need to attach it to the individual deed since it's already registered as part of the plat.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Evan, the first couple items there, you talked about them being don't need to be restated in Chapter 10, but then there's a comment that Chapter 10 needs to be amended when you talk about Section 2.211. What are you referring to? I was confused by that. Are you saying these items are not going to be in Chapter 10?
That's right. These two items will not be in Chapter 10, but we are saying they must appear in every
CCR, yeah. Right.
Because they are essential to the functioning of, to the enforceability of the subdivision and to standards. Now, the inspection and reporting requirement is one that Plum Creek has proposed. Mm-hmm. We have made a couple of suggested modifications, as you can see. One is that this is something that would be an approvable or enforceable provision by the commission. You know, mm-hmm. The report's got to meet the quality standards that the commission would have for the report. The inspector's qualifications would have to be subject to the commission's approval. It can't just be somebody who was looking for a part-time summer job. It would have to be somebody who understands a forester, hydrogeologist, professional mm-hmm. engineer, somebody who's qualified to look at the questions of vegetative clearing and water quality, which are the two items that these mm-hmm. Inspection is particularly going to. And also, we are suggesting that this occur annually and not mm-hmm. biannually, by which the Plum Creek intended to mean once every 2 years.
Okay.
The other item we're saying must be in the CCRs, but will not be in Chapter 10 because it's a good piece of guidance. It gets into architectural design, and our judgment is that architectural design is beyond the custom mm-hmm. and practice and typically the skills of the commission staff to prescribe, but there are some good suggestions there that would, in fact, help reduce visual impacts, and that it's important guidance to the homeowners, and so it should be a required element of the CCRs. The other element, did that answer your question,
yeah.
Mr. Chair?
That's good.
Okay. There are then a couple of elements that should be can stay in the CCRs if the applicant wants, but they need to be in the pocket park of Chapter 10. remember that CCRs are primarily a document intended to protect one homeowner against the other homeowners. To the extent that there are provisions that are needed to protect the public interest as opposed to private intra-homeowner association interests, then those items should be in Chapter 10. And there are two of those items which we have referred to earlier as part of the scenic standards that will become part of the pocket part of Chapter 10, and they relate to the materials and colors of siding and building materials, and of course to the whole vegetative clearing standard. And so those things must go into the pocket part. They can also appear in the CCRs. Probably would be a good idea if they did, or at least had reference, but they would have to exactly duplicate the language of Chapter 10. And then there are three items that appear in the sample CCR that are already included or would be included in Chapter 10, and the language in the CCR must be consistent with the language in Chapter 10, and those relate to maximum building height, the docks and the limitations on docks, and to some of the design of walking trails in the shore area.
Is there any change there from the existing Chapter 10 as we know it?
There, only in the docks, there are specific limitations, as we've discussed, on the number of docks and the colors of material of docks. So that would be a pocket part. The building height is already part of Chapter 10, and the requirement on walking trails is already part of Chapter 10. We're also suggesting that relevant amendments be subject to your approval, and that that the homeowners association as a whole could be liable for violations relating to common property within the development. And that would be the set of changes we are suggesting.
Everybody okay with that?
Aga's pointed out on 125 there is this catch-all that we want to, again, have one last bite at the apple to make sure that we're catching everything that are the minimally required CCR elements consistent with all the above recommendations.
If you want to add one more thing to your list, you're welcome to it.
No, this was really not intended to add anything to the list as much as to make sure that the title of these CCRs is being of a sample nature isn't inadvertently interpreted down the road as discretionary and subject to change at subdivision review. Mm-hmm. And rather what we would like to see is a document that is indeed a template and that includes the minimum required elements as we have presented them here and makes clear that those provisions must be included in each subsequent CCR, homeowner association CCR, and that of course additional subdivision specific conditions could also be added to that document. So that's what that was intended to capture.
Okay, Steve?
Just one quick question on 124.227, the docks. The provision will be amended so there will be a finite number of common docks with no individual docks for each development area. However, there are development areas where there will be. So this is just applied to certain. Okay.
I don't see any other questions on that one issue. If not, that takes us to the second tier issues, which you've recommended we don't talk about. Is that a good summary of that one?
More or less, yes. we recognize that as the dialogue has occurred, there have been a number of these implementation-type issues that have arisen, and we are certain that there are many, many more that go to kind of the devil in the details category that we see as very important, but we feel that shouldn't either cannot or should not be addressed at this stage until we get direction from the commission on the other, the key, what we see as the core elements of the plan.
In this context, generally, there are issues that aren't directly related to the concept plan, but are, I think, implementation issues, and that is the impact on LURC administratively in implementing this proposed concept plan, should it come to fruition. Again, the number of subdivision resort applications that are presented, the sequencing of those, I mean, could impose a very substantial burden on the commission. And I know we now have provisions that for certain types of extraordinary applications, the fee is adjustable. But if we're dealing with, for example, a proposal for a resort in the Lily Bay, up in the boonies there, it may not approach that level. I just think we need to look at, someone needs to look at some point, what the impact is going to be on the Maine Land Use Regulation Commission and its staff, and how that's going to be addressed. And I'm not suggesting that it should fall completely on the applicant. I mean, there may be some of that. But, I mean, I think we need to be aware of that up front because, you know, this is all great, but if we don't have the capacity to implement, oversee, then it seems to me that we've really dropped the ball here. And I think at the least, the legislature and the governor's office should be aware of the potential implications, fiscal implications, and resource implications here. I don't know how others feel about that, but I just raised that.
It's a very important point. It falls in the category of a number of the community services. This is a community service. It's code enforcement. And we ask the applicant in their analysis through planning decisions to address this and Eastern Maine Development Corporation. They interviewed at some length staff at LURC, the enforcement staff. So some of the needs are actually been quantified in those reports, personnel and dollars. In the end, I don't know all there is to know about the special application fee. My guess is that that would not apply to individual subdivision applications that will come in as a result of this. But in the end, it will be a matter of the commission and the Department of Conservation making its case to the legislature that some of the dollars that will have been raised as a result of this development should flow back to the commission to fund these services. It's not a great answer, but it's the same thing that Maine Forest Service and Bureau of Public Lands and other agencies that are going to be affected by this scale of development have to face.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the solution to this is, but I think that we ought to be cognizant of that.
Yeah, just to supplement that, we have given this a lot of thought, and to the extent that we have been able to infuse the design of the concept plan and the enforceability of these standards, we have tried to do so in the recommendations we've made. One of those in particular that I think will be of significant value to the commission and to its permitting and enforcement staff is Plum Creek's proposal to require on a regular basis a third-party self-enforcing mechanism for vegetation clearing and water quality that we discussed in the CCRs. I personally think that is a very creative and a critical means by which LURC can be informed of any violations so that it can take the necessary actions to resolve them. That may not necessarily address the permitting burden that will be faced by this agency, but I think Evan's reflection on the flow of dollars, the record evidence that there will be adequate funds, however the flow of dollars may pose some challenges. We feel that it's each individual agency's responsibility to make the case to its legislative board of the need that it has.
Yeah, I just think it'd be sad if we sort of constructed the Crystal Palace and couldn't sweep the floors, so to speak, you know what I mean?
Well, I think it has to be almost preemptive because the application fees will cover some of it, but we need the staff to look at the application. So
that's right.
They have to be on board before the wave of application hits. So that's the case, I think, that we have to make. Yeah.
Well, I am pleased to see the solution that's been proposed, having the annual inspections and having an entity that would report to LURC about compliance or enforcement issues. But the problem is right now our staff has its hands full just with permitting. It can't even address the enforcement. I mean, I'm not saying it can't, but it's overburdened already, and so it may be getting reports of these enforcement or compliance issues, but still may not be able to address them. So it's nice that they'll notice will be made or notification will come forward, but if we still don't have the manpower to address those, we haven't, as Ed said, we can't sweep the floor. And I think it's been one of my overarching concerns is that so much effort has been put into this plan to present what would be sort of a best-case scenario with the regulations and the standards and trying to ensure minimum impacts to recreation and wildlife, scenic values, but all of those things will come to nothing if we can't enforce those regulations and those standards. And so I urge whatever efforts that can be made to ensure that the funding to make this plan go forward the way it's been proposed is put in place. And I don't know all the mechanisms, but it just seems like we've been spending 3 years doing all of this, and wouldn't it be a shame if it all sort of came crumbling down if we couldn't make it come to fruition?
You probably will have a chance to testify before the Legislature Appropriations Committee on that issue, because that's where it ultimately will rest, I think.
Just on this issue, for our limited purposes of staff and consultants hearing changes that you want, I'm not hearing, and I'm not saying this to provoke anything, I'm just saying I want everyone to be clear, we are not taking back from this discussion, which I totally understand and get, that there is a proposed addition to our recommendations that essentially Plum Creek self-fund this twin permitting and enforcement issues that you've raised.
Certainly not. There may be, I wouldn't want to foreclose that being a part of a very big mix, I mean, through fees and things like that. But I don't think any of us are proposing that the entire cost. I mean, there is a public benefit here, and the public has to become, you know, step forward, and I think shoulder the responsibility to a certain extent in return for the public benefit. I don't think any of us are proposing that.
Let's not get caught in the trap of thinking that all this is going to happen in the next year either. Right. This is a 30-year plan.
That's true.
Right, and my narrow point is that within the concept plan approval process, as opposed to changes in statute to allow fees or additional staffing, which is outside the zoning petition that you have in front of you, there's no proposed changes here.
Well, right, I don't think that's Plum Creek's responsibility. Okay. I think it's up to the state of Maine to take care of some of these things or all of them.
For my part, I preface my remarks by saying I think this is outside the concept plan.
That being said, have we made it through, Aga?
Yes, we have. Congratulations and thank you. I do want to highlight for you a couple of topics that I wrote down as areas that the commission seemed to wish to circle back to. And on my short list, I have a continued discussion on Lily Bay and potentially the total number of units, although I was unclear about that, and also a discussion or a revisit of the subdivision design standards and maybe some illustrations to share with you on that.
Ed, you were asking for some specific on design standards that...
If I'm the only one that has this concern, then maybe we don't want to spend a lot of time on it. But my concern was the proposal to reduce the shoreline requirements. And I understand the logic behind that, and it rests on this notion of good planning. Mm-hmm. I forget the term of art you used, the good planning concepts or whatever.
Good planning is it, yeah.
Okay, good planning. I just want to make sure that those good planning standards are in place with some kind, other than just sort of general advisory, and they are directly linked to the reduction in the shorefront requirement. And when I went back and looked at the exact language, Do you know the page that's on? I mean, it'll take me a few minutes to write through this. But when I looked at the language in here.
Page 62.
62. Thank you, Arga. The commission directs staff and consultants to develop additional detailed concept plan amendment language. But I think that what I read here, I have no objection to. It's just I would like, in our little dialogue yesterday, I wasn't clear on the extent to which these design standards. And let me back up. We begin with the idea that ring around the lake in certain areas is prohibited by the very construction of the concept plan itself or from existing conservation easements or limitations on development. And therefore, some of the concerns about shore frontage or allowing concentrated shore frontage are to a certain extent mitigated. But I am still concerned about linear development along the shoreline. And again, my reason for that is that LURC, throughout its entire history, has, in a sense, battled this issue. Now, again, absent the idea that a good portion of a lake or water body is going to be protected. So I think that what we need to do is we have to make sure that any reduction in required shore frontage is tied to certain design standards. I understand your point.
My view, and I think what is represented in the staff recommendations on this issue, both embedded in the recommendation on page 62, as well as the long-term development plan objectives and review criteria, which are outlined on page 58, will achieve that design. I do want to say, however, that and perhaps this is where we differ in our views, that linear development design is a problem in LURC jurisdiction for very specific reasons. And it's not a problem per se to have a stretch of shoreline developed particularly if it's developed in a manner that has the broader outlook on good planning principles.
As long as we're assured that that is the case. Because the whole shorelands frontage issue is akin to our principle of adjacency. It was a fallback measure that we use as a sort of a surrogate to address a number of issues. And while it may have outlived its purpose in terms of specific application within a concept plan, to imply that we're giving that up would be, in my view, to imply we're giving up adjacency as a general criterion for rezoning. You see what I mean? I just want to be very clear that the reason we're doing this is because the nature of the concept plan itself and the conservation easements that provided, and also design characteristics of the individual subdivisional resorts. Because I have yet to see, while I've heard us talk about that connection in the past, I have yet to see it.
We are in agreement on that.
Okay. And yeah.
Evan and I pulled out some illustrations that might, if you're interested, we could share with you to kind of indicate what we have in mind as what might be necessary to achieve the objectives that are embedded in our recommendations.
Sure.
And I'm going to ask Evan to take the lead on explaining this piece. And these illustrations, came from the 2006 concept plan proposal from Plum Creek. They are part of the record. They were filed as part of Plum Creek's 2006 proposal as illustrative designs of some subdivisions.
And as we look at these and we talk about, you know, what is this good planning concept, everything, I think we need to think about the answers that we'll give to the next subdivision planner who comes along and says, how come I have to use 200 feet of shoreline? Those guys only used X.
That's the point.
I think if you that's specifically acknowledged the way I read it in the language that they wrote in here, that they say that in the context of this concept plan, the purpose 3, which was the lakeshore protection, was effectively achieved through the conservation mazes that prohibit development on a lot of lake shores. So,
but I don't necessarily completely buy that. This is where I think there's a slightly difference of opinion. I mean, I think you can have a well-preserved lakeshore, but then have these concentrated, ghettoized lots that, in terms of, could have a concentrated impact on a number of resource values. So, I think that we need to look at not just the general requirement that a concept plan or some kind of conservation easement be in place, but that we actually look at the design characteristics and their natural resource value, site-specific natural resource value impacts. And if I could be assured that that was the case, it'd be fine. I guess where I got a little bug in my saddle was over an implication that the design requirements were advisory, not, and I think if I saw the logical nexus between the reduction of shore frontage and the minimization of natural resource site-specific impacts through some kind of design characteristics, I'd feel much more comfortable. And again, not just in the context of this concept plan, but the next person that comes in here and wants to know why they are not being accorded that same kind of collapse of the... I just don't want this to be a camel's nose under the tent to go back to the old days when we were, you know, lot, and no back lots, and I think a terrible misuse of land and the amenity aspect of enjoying the resource and at the same time minimizing adverse impacts on it. So,
I think we completely understand your point and agree with it. The fact that there is a concept plan with a lot of conserved shore frontage does not mean that the remaining shore frontage is a free fire zone. It's one of the reasons that we're suggesting that the language of 1025Q3 be reinstated to include some of those design elements. But on the other hand, at the same time, we do want to acknowledge that there is a lot of conserved shoreline, that one of the answers to the next subdivider comes in is, sure, give us 10,000 feet of shoreline and you get some of the same consideration.
Well,
but given that conservation, we think that that warrants looking at some flexibility in design that will not do an injustice to the remaining shoreline, and that's what we, but we need to think that through.
I don't mind flexibility in design at all, but I think the standards that are applied to evaluate the appropriateness of that flexibility are what I'm,
sure.
I want to make sure explicit.
Yep.
I think there's a precedent here, Ed. In recent times, we looked at a higher density than normal situation on Monhegan, and we determined that they had no other place to go, and that technology had grown enough so that more people could live on one piece of land without affecting it, and that actually we should be thinking that this technology will improve. So I think the same case can be made for the lakefront, where they're constrained by conservation. As long as the development fits the LURC standards, which the Monhegan, we kind of altered the standards to adapt to a smaller landmass.
I thought we were keeping that quiet.
Well, you know, I mean, it's different to put 10 people in a row or 10 people in a circle, as long as the septic systems, the water systems, the infrastructure can handle it. And there have been tremendous advances in capacity over the last few years.
I agree.
So it's not out of, you know, character to consider something like this with all those safeguards in place.
It's the safeguards in place. I agree with you.
So here are some examples. They're part of the record. They come from the 2006 plan when Plum Creek was providing some of the templates that they were considering for different parts of their development areas. I emphasize that at this point these are not part of the current concept plan, but I think that it may be that if this recommendation that the commission direct us to develop additional detailed language to operationalize some of these objectives with respect to the sense of place, form, function, purpose of 1025Q and the efficient use of land, that some additional templates or new templates would emerge from that. This is an example of a plan that would meet your current, a portion of your current, well, your current standard that says that the subdividers to avoid the shark tooth kind of layout and employ breaks so that no more than 1,320 feet, 8 or 1,320 feet broken by 500 feet would occur along the shoreline. And here is an example where there is that kind of design.
I just want to point out this is a reference to Section 1025Q3, where this is the alternative option if a developer cannot meet the community service standard. So if for practical, you know, that there's a definition in there, for practical purposes, they cannot meet the preferred design element, this would be the fallback. And this is kind of characterized by development that predated the 2004 rules.
Okay. I think it's pretty obvious what the elements there are, the main access road, a logging road, then a private road coming down to serve the lots, and then a single-loaded road with the lots running between the road for their driveways down to the water, but with 100-foot setbacks that you require and so forth. Amy, let's try this one first. And then I might want to come back to it for just another description. But here's an example. This actually meets the 1025R standards for a cluster development in which the idea is there is a specific requirement that at least 50% of the developable area has to be in open space, and at least 50% of the developable shoreline has to be undeveloped. But here you can see the idea of a focal point, or what the ordinance or Chapter 10 refers to as a community center, where the number 4 is located. You can also see open space to the left and to the right, which is community open space. It includes a common trail for shore access and recreation, and it includes two tiers of lots, some on the shore and some on the second tier at the other side of this focal point, this community space. And I want to come back and talk about why that works, why it's important in a minute.
I do want to highlight that this is a perfect example of what a typical subdivision might look like, or what an approvable subdivision design might look like on a Class 4 lake like Upper Wilson under current LURC standards, where we would require a set aside of 50% of the shoreline. And here, the recommendation that we're making with respect to Upper Wilson would modify this design to allow for that remaining 50% of open space to be developed into shorefront lots. That doesn't mean that preservation of the shorelines wouldn't exist or wouldn't have to be included, because to the extent that any natural resources existed, like, for example, the presence of wetlands shown in the light green or other sensitive resources, those clearly would have to be avoided and would need to be taken into consideration into the design.
And I clearly buy the rationale that some of the additional space here, the requirement for I forget how many acres.
It's a percentage.
Can be met by the conservation around the lake.
Right.
I don't have any problem with that. I just would like to see this made explicit some way.
Where is your lake access point?
If you see number 6, there's actually, to the left of that, there's actually a little winding trail that comes down from the road, which is, depiction, a common access trail.
That whole side
trail.
Is open space as well.
That's right.
Oh,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Oh, so the 50% is in the center, and you're still pulling out the two wetland areas. I didn't see
that's
that.
Right.
I thought
yes.
they were the 50%.
Yep.
Gotcha. Great.
Because it's under the clustering, 50% of buildable area
right.
has to be set aside.
Yeah, very good.
If we go to the third one, which is more of a what Plum Creek styled as a neighborhood kind of design that might occur in a larger scale development where there's more than one subdivision, you can see what one design might look like. It is a combination of hillside lots, larger lots, shoreline lots, and back lots with common space or focal point space or community space, however you might want to call it, and common access points. And in this example, there are breaks between these subdivisions, which might be governed. Might have come in at different times as applications, but under our style, under our recommendations, would have to be part of a long-term development plan, and with showing how circulation connects. Here you can see a interconnection of the circulation system, and how open space connects. This is not a recommendation. This is just an example of what they presented as part of their 2006 plan.
Right. I understand. I guess I don't want to go any further, because I mean I think you understand what my concerns are here, and I want to be very clear. I am not in any way implying that Plum Creek is going to have some kind of incentive to go in there and do this shark tooth thing that you're suggesting. I'm more concerned about the precedent we're setting and its application, as Steve suggests, the next person that comes in the door.
Well, this is a good answer to that.
And it's a good answer, but what I'm wondering is, to what extent are the sixes, see the sixes in there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they weren't there, and that was all condensed, would that still be approvable? It would be, right?
If they weren't there, back lots would have no shore frontage.
The only way that that scenario would be approvable would be if you found at the long-term planning phase and then each subsequent subdivision phase that there was no need to protect existing natural resources on the shoreline, such as wetlands.
Okay.
There was no need within a development area to provide for on-site recreation facilities. There was no need to provide for habitat considerations like wildlife corridor protections. If that area had no natural resource constraints and for some reason needed no recreational facilities or on-site amenities, which in my opinion is highly unlikely for any of these areas, then I guess theoretically you could get a proposal in that where every foot of shoreline within a development area is proposed for development, and you would have to assess that against the long-term development plan criteria that we are recommending, if you choose to accept those, as well as the current LURC established design standards in 1025Q.
Naga, what's the date of 1025Q? When was that promulgated?
Those rules were adopted in, I believe, in April of 2004.
But we have not seen any proposals like this since then.
I can't speak to what has been approved at the subdivision phase since then. Yeah. I know that the commission or the staff, depending on who made this decision, did have to make a finding that the design standards of 1025Q were met as part of its review since then.
Well, I take that back. I guess burnt jacket probably would fall.
But we haven't seen the actual subdivision approval of that. I mean, I haven't seen the approved layout. I mean, I don't know. I know what was approved in concept at the rezoning stage, and there were some issues, and we were assured that they'd be addressed at the subdivision review, and I'm sure they were. But I mean, I haven't seen that, and it may be that just the 2004, we just haven't had a lot of subdivision proposals.
Anyway, this is very exciting. I mean, for a lot of years, I sat here and said, let's do this. And real estate agents would say, everybody wants his own dock so he can put his feet in the water on his own land. So, no, we're not going to do that. And we said, oh, okay. But if we have teeth to hold to this is great.
And I agree.
I think that's it. We hear what you've said, and we do continue to think that we need to work to assure that as 1025Q3 is reinstated, that we have the opportunity to create to look at the dimensional requirements that might be associated with this particular concept plan in view of the big picture that they have presented.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think what I want to do now is give Lisa a little break and ourselves. We'll take 15 minutes, and when we come back, we'll spend a few minutes more. I think we want to talk a little bit about Lily Bay again and maybe total units. And then
one other item that I'd like to add to the list in response to Commissioner Kurtz's information request. We did locate some information about the FPL response to what could and could not occur within the FERC easement areas.
Okay.
I'm happy to share that with
you
as well.
That would be good. And then I think following that, we'll go through the table of contents, and I'm just going to ask you to kind of see if there's anything left on the table that you're uncomfortable with so that the staff is clear on what they have to do next. And then after we consult with the staff, we'll try to determine before we leave here tonight, we want to be able to tell ourselves and everybody else what it is we're going to do next, when we're going to do it, more than what we're going to do. So let's come back at 3:15, please.